Okay, you guys have any questions about anything? It's all clear to you what's expected for the midterm, yeah?
Well, it's not really about the midterm, but just a general question.
Yeah?
I know this is a period of time, a lot of
people are going to be
going on.
Right.
How are the
politics? Okay. It's a good question. Where you're getting a little ahead of the class. We're going to have the midterm on Monday. Then on Wednesday, I'm going to actually deal with the whole issue of imperialism. Because imperialism becomes really important in the post-Bismarckian period, that's to say the period after 1890. Why is it important? Because of its impact on relations among the great European powers. It's one of the key elements in the story that leads to the First World War. And it's an interesting point because you have the entire continent of Africa basically being divided up in this period. A lot of these things are triggered by the British occupation of Egypt in 1882. Africa is divided up. That doesn't lead to a European war. You have crises over African issues. For example, you have the two Moroccan crises in 1905, 1906, and then again in 1911, but you don't have a war. But still, it plays a very important role. And especially, it comes to dominate Anglo-German relations, because Germany has this, you know, develops these imperial aspirations after Bismarck falls in 1890. And that puts Germany on a collision course with England. Remember how I referred to the First World War as kind of the coming together of these three great conflicts in European politics, between France and Germany over Alsace-Lorraine, between Austria and Russia over the Balkans, and then between Germany and Britain over these imperial colonial naval issues. But it's part of the later story. Later story. 1890 is a real important watershed. And in fact, that's why I chose to give the midterm exam for the period up to 1890, because it's a very nice, you know, way of kind of dividing the class into these two parts. But good question, but you're getting a little ahead of things, yeah? Yes? Yeah. Well, this is a departure from the basic spirit of the Bismarckian policy. Why would he do it? Right? He didn't buy the arguments about they're basically ethnic Germans or anything like that. He thought that was nonsense. It wasn't for economic reasons either. I explained to you about the Thomas process. It was only developed after this decision was made. So the iron ore deposits in Lorraine, you know, they weren't any good for the production of steel. He hadn't developed the technology for using it. So you can kind of go through these various things. Was it public opinion? No, public opinion is manipulated by Bismarck. He has this thing, the Reptile Fund. Basically, it's this big slush fund that he uses to kind of pay off journalists and so on. Let me just finish with the question, then I'll get to you. So what is it? There's a military argument to be made. That border there between France and Germany is this mountain range. It's not a huge mountain range like the Alps, but it's a significant military barrier. It's called the Vosges. And the general said, we need more defensible frontiers. So that's why we need to take this area, because we need to kind of control those mountain passes. And normally, for someone like Bismarck, military arguments take a back seat to political considerations. You know, that's the essence of the Clausewitz philosy. Military considerations should be subordinate. Political considerations should dominate policy, right? That's the essence of the Clausewitzian thinking. And Bismarck normally would buy into that. You know, international politics is about political issues. So. But he went along with this stuff semi-reluctantly. And there's a quotation, in the Taylor book on Bismarck. He actually quotes a truncated version of this quotation to kind of show you that, well, Bismarck really didn't want to take Alsace-Lorraine. He says, he quotes Bismarck as saying, I don't like to see so many Frenchmen in our house who don't want to be there. In other words, you pay a domestic political price because you have universal manhood suffrage, and these people who thought of themselves as French, they're always going to vote against the government, right? It's going to make it much harder to control the Reichstag. But the full quotation is, I don't want to see so many Frenchmen in our house who don't want to be there, but the generals say that we need Metz, and perhaps they're right, right? The full quotation is rather different. But why did Bismarck bend to the will of the generals? And the answer there is because he bought into this notion that a new war with France is inevitable, right? Very different from his attitude toward Austria in 1866. Say, let's have a soft peace so as to pave the way for reconciliation, for possible future alignment. That was his attitude in 1866. He didn't take that attitude in 1871. And you start looking at why that was the case, and it was just like this kind of crude national prejudice. The French will never accept the new status quo. The French have traditionally thought of themselves as the number one power in Europe. They can't resign themselves to not being the dominant power in Europe, and so on. In fact, France had not been the dominant power in Europe since 1814, right? Since the defeat of Napoleon. But so you have that element in it, right? So why is that important for our purposes? Because it feeds into the analysis of the kind of core conceptual issue that we're concerned with, which is this whole issue of power politics. Right? Is power politics a source of instability? And what this points to is, no, it's not power politics that was the source of the problem. It was the failure to behave rationally in power political terms, to allow your policy to be shaped by, crude national prejudice and so on. And it's an important point, right? Yeah. No. That's just to help you, because I may be referring to these things in passing. I just want to make sure you know how to spell them. it's not serious. Right? By the way, if you ever write Bismarck, don't forget the C. A lot of people spell Bismarck B-I-S-M-A-R-K, but that's incorrect. And that sort of thing creates a very bad impression on the reader. The test for you is, how important is that? And especially, does this relate to the kind of core themes of the class? The kind of these things at that level of detail, like today, the terms of the reinsurance treaty, no. What you have to know about the reinsurance treaty is that it's Bismarck's link with Russia, that the reinsurance treaty was between Germany and Russia. But you don't have to know the terms. I mean, I'll talk about this stuff, but I don't want you to not see the forest for the trees. I want you to kind of focus on these kind of big issues and understand the factual side to the extent that it's necessary to kind of make sense of the big issues. Like the very first class with those. Tables about industrial production and so on. Obviously, I'm expecting you to know every little detail there, but you should know the big stuff. That the shift in the balance of economic power that takes place in the course of the century. This is a fundamental element in the story. If you think that, well, basically the relationship between England and Russia was the same in the middle of the century as it was at the beginning, you're missing something that's important. Okay. Anything else? Nothing else? I thought that's another hand. Okay. And remember what I said. I think the best way to prepare is like little study groups where you try and guess what the questions would be and ask each other. All right. Well, last time I talked about the whole Gladstone phenomenon from 1879 to 1885. And it's a very interesting story in its own terms. It's like comes in this whole wave of enthusiasm, very idealistic foreign policy concept. And in the course of trying to implement that concept, he alienates every other major power in Europe. You know, I quoted that wonderful line from Salisbury. He said, oh yeah, Gladstone's achieved his concert of Europe, all right. You know, he's united all of Europe against England. And in fact, Gladstone is so discredited that by 1885, following the Penge incident, which brought Britain and Russia over to the brink of war over Central Asia, Afghanistan, Gladstone is totally discredited. The liberal government is totally discredited, and the conservatives come back to power. New conservative government under Salisbury takes office in 1885. Right? And Salisbury rapidly reestablishes Britain's position, Britain's relations with Germany and Austria especially. Right? Practically overnight, Britain is no longer isolated. So it's a very interesting story. It's like, you know, because you look at Gladstone and your heart tells you, yeah, this is the way to go. Foreign policy should be based on the love of liberty and so on. Not on power politics. And you see how basing a policy on your heart instead of your head can just lead to real trouble, not just for your own country, but for the system as a whole. This was not a source of stability. So that whole analysis of the Gladstone phenomenon was interesting, not just in its own terms, not just as a historical episode, historical reasons, but because it enables us to get a handle on the core conceptual issues that we're concerned with in this class. And it's like basically it's this whole problem of power politics. Here you have a system of sovereign states. You know, no world government, no supranational authority or anything like that. In a system of sovereign states, the outcome of political disputes is determined by relative power. So you have to be concerned about power. Well, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And does that lead to war? Or does it lead to a more stable international system than any of the alternatives you can think about? And so we're trying to assess these different approaches to foreign policy in a world of sovereign states. Right? We spent a lot of time looking at Bismarck because you think of him as the premier practitioner of power politics. Right? System based on power, that such a system creates certain incentives for states to pursue policies that are attuned to power political realities that make sense in power political terms, rational in power political terms. To the extent that states pursue those kinds of policies, you know, does that lead to stability or instability? You know, is power politics a good thing or a bad thing? All those kinds of issues we tried to get a handle on by looking at the Bismarckian experience, and then also, one of the great alternatives, the liberal approach to foreign policy, you know, you associate with Gladstone, and you try and get a handle on the whole question of whether that leads to a stable international order by looking in at some detail at the Gladstone experience through the lens of those kinds of concerns. So that was the issue there. So as I said, Gladstone falls in 1885. And Salisbury comes back to power. And in the late 1880s, Bismarck is again at the kind of center of things. And you have a system take shape. The climax of the Bismarckian system, that's not my term, you find it in a lot of the historical accounts referring to this period. And a lot of these historical works take a very favorable view of what Bismarck was able to accomplish in that period. There's a famous book written in the early 1930s, I think it was, by William Langer called European Alliances and Alignments. And this is an analysis of European politics during the Bismarckian period following the unification of Germany to Bismarck's fall from power in 1890, in a 20-year period. And Langer takes the view that the sort of structure that Bismarck had created, a whole network of alliances and alignments, you know, with Austria, the Austro-German alliance in 1879, Austria's ties in the Balkans, Germany and Austria's ties with Romania, the triple alliance with Italy, I'm going to see today, the alliance, treaty at least, with Russia, the reinsurance treaty between Germany and Russia in 1887. And the Mediterranean agreements, which brought Britain in, the Britain of Salisbury, into the system in 1887. We'll see that Britain is also part of the system directed at the containment of Russian power, cooperation with Austria to kind of keep Russia at bay. This whole structure of alliances and alignments, this was terrific because it managed to stabilize the status quo, according to Langer. Everybody was checkmated. No one could move. Everyone was locked into the status quo. Okay? As the situation stood at the end of 1887, this is how Langer ends his chapter on dealing with all this stuff, on Bismarck, guardian of the peace. As the situation stood at the end of 1887, no power could move without involving itself in endless difficulties and dangers. The sanctions of peace lay in the great alliance system, which spread over Europe like a huge web. Bismarck was denounced and misunderstood, but for him, the preservation of peace was worth it. All right? And then it begins the very next chapter about talking about how the powers were so enmeshed in an elaborate scheme of insurance treaties, reinsurance treaties, agreements, and understandings that it was almost impossible for any one of them to act without bringing all the others upon the scene. Under the circumstances, there was, as Bismarck himself said, a premium upon the maintenance of peace. Right? So the claim is, this was just locked everyone into the international system as it was. This structure, this complicated alliance structure, was a bulwark of the peace, with the implication that if this whole thing fell apart and Europe moved rapidly toward toward conflict in the post-Bismarckian period, after Bismarck fell in 1890, really dismissed from office by the new emperor, then if you want to understand the First World War, you have to understand it in terms of the role of individuals. It's a great man theory of history. As long as Bismarck is there, everything is great. He knew how to maintain a stable international order. As soon as Bismarck is gone, no one knows how to do it, and you have this movement toward the war, right? And that conclusion, if it's correct, is very important for our purposes because it implies that international politics is not to be understood in structural terms, a la Kenneth Waltz, but rather in terms of contingency. Who happens to be in charge of policy? You know, whether you have a great man like Bismarck with his hand at the helm, or whether policy is in the hands of people who don't really quite know what they're doing, can't pursue this sort of policy. Right. So this issue is important for our purposes. And so the way we're going to bring that issue into focus is starting looking at the climax of the Bismarckian system in the late 1880s and asking, how stable was this system? Was it true that everyone was just locked into the status quo? Everyone was checkmated, to use Langer's phrase. All right? So that's the set of questions that you have to take to the analysis of the historical record on this period. So what happened? Again, it's not something that developed automatically out of the workings of great power politics. The a crisis developed in the 1885 and came to a climax in 1887. This is another Near Eastern crisis. We talked about the great Near Eastern crisis of the late 1870s. Now there's another Near Eastern crisis, in fact, the Bulgarian crisis, in the late 1880s. Now what's the story here? Well, you recall the settlement of the previous Near Eastern crisis that was registered at the Congress of Berlin in 1878. Basically, the grandiose Russian policy that the Russians had tried to implement following the defeat of Turkey in the Russo-Turkish War in 1877, a settlement embodied in the Treaty of San Stefano, whose key feature was the creation of a very large Bulgarian state with shores, with its borders not just on the shores of the Black Sea, but also even on the Aegean. You can see from that ethnographic map, or maybe not too clearly, but in fact that whole area, kind of border areas around Bulgaria, is an area of very mixed populations. You have areas that have both Bulgars and Greeks, areas that have both Bulgars and Serbs, and so on. So you don't have any obvious ethnographic boundaries for the new Bulgarian state. So the Russians wanted to create a large Bulgaria, which they assumed would be a powerful state, and in fact would be a Russian satrapy, an extension of Russian power. And this new Bulgarian state, in fact, was to be run by Russia, right? The Treaty of San Stefano was torn up, but there would still be a Bulgarian state created, a small, much smaller state. In fact, it was divided into two parts. Bulgaria proper, with its own king, and then southern Bulgaria was called Eastern Rumelia. They, instead of calling it southern Bulgaria, they thought that, well, if we give it a different name, it'll impede the unification of the two parts of Bulgaria. But southern Bulgaria would be separate. Eastern Rumelia would have a Christian governor general. Turks wouldn't be allowed to occupy. But the Bulgaria proper was in effect run by the Russians. The ministers were in fact Russians, Russian officers. The Minister of War, for example, was a very important figure in Bulgarian, Bulgarian affairs. His name is General Kolbars, I wrote it there. It's a Russian general, you know? Minister of War, ran the Bulgarian military establishment. Bulgarian civil servants were Russian, right? And the whole notion on the part of the Russians was, well, they didn't get very much out of their war against Turkey, but they did get something. What they had gotten was the recognition that Bulgaria would be in their sphere of influence, that they would get to run Bulgaria, and Bulgaria would be an important base for the extension of Russian influence in the Balkans and toward Constantinople. This was not an idealistic policy at all during the reign of Tsar Alexander II, Tsar Liberator. He had liberated the serfs within Russia itself. There had been a certain element of idealism in Russian policy, the sense of Russia's historic mission, which was the freeing of the Slavic populations in southeastern Europe from the Turkish yoke. But now Alexander II died and was replaced by Alexander III, and the whole tenor of Russian policy shifted. It became much, much darker, much narrower, more nationalistic. You know, this is the period of the pogroms within Russia, for example. And Alexander III, he said in 1885, "In my view, we ought to have one principal aim, the occupation of Constantinople, so that we may once and for all maintain ourselves at the straits and know that they will remain in our hands. That is in the interest of Russia and ought to be our aspiration. Everything else that takes place in the Balkan Peninsula is secondary for us. There has been enough propaganda to the detriment of the true interest of Russia. The Slavs must now serve Russia and not we them." Okay? Very, you know, narrow parochial approach to these things. Well, all of this had its effect on the situation within Bulgaria. And it led to, you know, quite a large degree of resentment on the part of the Bulgarians against their new Russian overlords, who were no longer viewed as liberators, but rather as oppressors. And so you have this phenomenon, Bulgarian nationalism. I talked about this before. People are surprised by it. No one had expected it. Nationalism is a phenomenon of Western Europe. And when people see it in other parts of the world, last time I read you letter that Gladstone sent to the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Granville, just expressing his amazement at Egyptian nationalism. Well, it's the same sort of thing is true even of the Christian populations of the Balkans. This, you know, this Bulgarian nationalism, I mean, people are quite surprised by it. And this has an enormous impact on the policies of the different powers involved. The Russians want to crush it because Bulgaria is supposed to be theirs. And in fact, Bismarck, in his attempt to keep relations with Russia relatively decent, had frequently said that the best solution to the whole Balkan problem, collapse of the Ottoman Empire, was to divide the Balkan Peninsula between East and West, between two spheres of influence, a Russian sphere of influence in the East and an Austrian sphere of influence in the West. You know, and that's a solution. That way everyone can get along, right? That was not his real policy, but that's the sort of thing he said. And for the Russians, this provided them with certain crumbs of support. You know, that sense of, well, the most important power in Europe is kind of on our side. And so the Russians, take measures to clamp down on Bulgarian nationalism. For example, they forced the abdication of the new Bulgarian king, who had Alexander Battenberg, who had identified himself with the Bulgarian national cause. But it didn't do any good because the ethnic Bulgarians, took the matter in their own hands. And there was this whole question of, you know, what to do about it. Now, all this issue these issues kind of come to a head in 1885 because there's a revolution in Philippopolis, which is the chief town in southern Bulgaria, which was called Eastern Rumelia. And the effect of the revolution was to bring about a unification of the two parts of Bulgaria, something the Bulgarians obviously wanted. This was in line with Bulgaria's, you know, nationalistic ambitions. And now, if the Russians oppose this, right? Because Bulgaria is no longer, willing to be a Russian satellite. Whereas the other powers, preeminently the Austrians and the British, now favor it. They had opposed the idea of a strong Bulgaria because they thought it would be, you know, a cat's paw for Russia. Now a strong nationalistic Bulgaria that was antagonistic to Russia, well, this is a very nice solution, especially for a liberal country like England. You know, because, you know, if your power political interests and your emotional aspirations kind of point in the same direction, that's a very nice thing. Salisbury says, you know, it says, well, we've got to change our policy. We backed the wrong horse in opposing the creation of a strong Bulgaria. Now we're in favor of it. Right? The Russians aren't about to allow these things to happen and see all the fruits of their military efforts in 1877 go down the drain and see themselves excluded from the Balkan Peninsula. And when it seemed that the Austrians are throwing their power into the balance on the Bulgarian side, or at least preventing the Russians from reasserting their control there through military means, then there's this whole risk now of a war between Russia and Austria, with maybe Britain coming into the war on the side of Austria, maybe Germany as well. In any case, Germany is put on the spot here. The Russians say, you know, well, you keep talking about how Bulgaria is in our sphere, you know, you got to support us. And the you know, the whole German argument of we're sympathetic with you, but we can't intervene in this doesn't cut very much ice with the Russians, because there's the sense of if push comes to shove and Russia gets involved in a war with Austria, Austria is weaker than Russia, and then it would be up to Germany to pull Austria's chestnuts out of the fire for her regardless. So Germany, willy-nilly, is bound to play a central role in this. Right? Now, Bismarck's really on the spot here as this Bulgarian business, you know, develops 1885, 1886, it kind of comes to a head in 1887. He doesn't want to really show his hand, which is to make it clear that Germany's weight is being thrown into the balance on behalf of a policy of the containment of Russian expansionism, of excluding Russia from the Balkans, right? Why does he not want that? Because if he did that, Russia would then go over to the side of France. If Russia went over to the side of France, Germany would be excessively dependent on her own alliance partner, Austria, maybe on excessively dependent on the British as well. It would make more sense to have good relations with Russia, not just to minimize the risk of a war on two fronts against both France and Russia, but in order to maintain Germany's freedom of action vis-a-vis her remaining allies, or Austria to a certain extent. Britain as well, Britain is involved in this. Right? So for power political reasons, Bismarck does not want to make it clear, or too clear, that he's siding with Austria against Russia. And why is this issue particularly important at this time, or salient, I should say? Because totally independent of this Balkan business, there's this kind of nationalist revival going on in France. And there's the French Minister of War named General Boulanger. He's like the famous man on horseback. In fact, he rented a white horse from the circus, which he would ride down the streets of Paris. And the Parisian crowds would cheer him, and there's all this nationalistic agitation and so on. It seemed that Boulanger was kind of, if he was able to kind of come to power, that it might very quickly lead to a French war. And so this is the worst time at all for Bismarck to have bad relations with Russia. So he doesn't want to show his hand, but he doesn't want to abandon Austria either. So what's the solution for Bismarck? The solution is to have the British basically do the dirty work. Have the British show their hand and throw British power into the balance on the anti-Russian side. Because Britain and Austria together would be sufficient to contain Russia. And Germany wouldn't have to show her own hand in all this. Right? And so there's this... all eyes are now on London. What will Lord Salisbury do? And Salisbury understood, Bismarck's predicament. In a sense, he didn't really want Russia to go over to the side of France, because then Russia would have a stronger ally. As long as Russia stayed away from France, and as long as there was a certain tie between Germany and Russia, well, that tie would be able, you know, would restrain Russia. Bismarck would be able to restrain Russia by threatening Russia that if she didn't behave herself, then she would lose Germany's friendship. And Germany would have to side more directly with Austria. So the system was kind of in Britain's interest too. I should say, just in passing, a couple of points in passing. This shows you that contrary to this historical myth, Britain had not opted for a policy of isolation in the 19th century. The policy of Victorian England in the 19th century was not one of splendid isolation. You still see people saying stuff like this. Britain was very much involved in the affairs of the continent. Okay? She was reluctant, however, to make formal alliances, arguing that the British Constitution, unwritten constitution, as you know, was inconsistent with the notion of formal alliances. Right? Britain basically wanted to keep a free hand. As long as you had these tensions among the European powers, Britain had a certain freedom of action here. Didn't have to commit herself to one side or the other because all of Europe is not going to gang up against Britain. That's the one notion. But they're involved. They don't want Russia to advance. Right? They're still committed to the containment of Russian power. That's going to change in part as a result of the British occupation of Egypt. Because for strategic reasons, the British are shifting the focus of their attention away from Constantinople and the Turkish Straits down to the Cairo-Suez area in Egypt. This is going to be their great base. This is going to be where they're going to take their stand in terms of blocking a Russian advance. Right? This will guarantee the security of their lifeline to India. All right, so but that's kind of in the future still. British strategic thinking is still in the process of flux. The second point I want to make in passing has to do with offense and defense. So this crisis is setting in between Russia on the one hand, Austria and Britain on the other. You have to ask yourself, who are the aggressors? Does it make sense to look at this crisis in terms of who are the aggressors? Who is starting? If it had led to war, could you say one side had started the war, the other side were just the defenders, the victims, the targets? A lot of the political science literature, the assumption is that you can make these hard and fast distinctions between war initiators and targets of war. But if war had begun over this, who would have been the aggressor? Russia, for trying to maintain her position in Bulgaria, a position which had been granted to her as a result of the events of the 1870s, you know, in exchange for allowing Austria to occupy Bosnia. In fact, Austria had been allowed to annex Bosnia if she had wanted, in the Western Balkans. Right? Isn't Russia just trying to maintain her position? Or were the Russians the aggressors? So Sontag has this kind of nice passage about this. This is on the bottom of page 38 of the Sontag book. He talks about, in general, we may say that both Russians and Austrians convinced themselves that they were seeking legitimate defensive objectives, but that each had good ground for suspecting the other of aggressive designs. You know, like this defensive-aggressive distinction is a lot more problematic than you might think. Very hard to kind of point your finger and say one side is the aggressor, the other side is the victor. That's kind of this. An important point in general, because if it's hard to identify aggressors, then you can scarcely say war is the result of aggression, and therefore all of your efforts at securing the peace should be based on the deterring of aggressors or the punishment of aggressors. Right? Okay. So finally, what happens is Salisbury moves in 1887 to commit British power to the anti-Russian side, to the containment of Russia, to preventing the Russians from reasserting their control over Bulgaria. And this policy is embedded in what was called the Mediterranean Agreements of 1887, a whole bunch of them. There are actually three of them. First between Britain and Italy, then between Britain and Austria, and then a further agreement between those three powers, kind of spelling things out in greater detail, in the course of the year 1887. The Mediterranean Agreements, an agreement to cooperate in the maintenance of the status quo in the Eastern Mediterranean, meaning basically in the Balkan Peninsula and the area around the Turkish Straits, and in fact in Bulgaria. Britain is throwing her power into the balance, meaning that Russia is deterred without Germany having to show her hands. Solving Bismarck's basic problem here of having to show his hand and thus alienate Russia, drive Russia over to the side of France at a time when the French are in an increasingly bellicose mood. Godsend, windfall for Bismarck, and it was precisely in order to bring about a British government with a policy of that sort, a policy that was congenial to Germany, that Germany had behaved as she had in 1884 in taking action directed at bringing Gladstone down, squashing him against the wall, driving him into the mire. Remember that quotation from Bismarck's son? All right. So Salisbury brings Britain into this whole web of alliances and alignments on the German side, basically, on the anti-Russian side, enabling Germany to maintain the status quo without alienating Russia unnecessarily, without driving Russia over to the side of France. Which is not to say that Germany did nothing to alienate Russia. And in fact, there was a famous move in 1887 that was made by the German government to prevent the Russians from selling bonds in the Berlin market. But there were limits to how far Bismarck would go. And he wanted to maintain the line to St. Petersburg. Hence, the reinsurance treaty of 1887. Bismarck's alignment, or his link with Russia. Not as strong a connection as his alliance with Austria of 1879, which is still very much alive. But it tends to dilute the impact of the alignment with Austria now that he has this Russian connection. And a good part of the reason the Russians had for entering into this alignment with Germany was their desire to prevent Germany from being too dependent on Austria, thus empowering Austria to pursue too much of an anti-Russian policy. Right? What does the reinsurance treaty provide for? It's basically a neutrality agreement. Those two powers agreed to remain neutral in the event either of them got into a war with another great power, with these two exceptions. If Russia attacked Austria, then Germany would be free to intervene, because the Russians were told about the terms of the Austro-German alliance. But it was only if Russia attacked Austria. Question is, well, what if Russia attacked Romania, for example? Germany had an alliance with Romania, a secret alliance. Now, part of the problem with this treaty structure is it has a weak point there. So the two exceptions. If Russia attacks Austria, not in the event of an Austro-Russian war, but it had to be a direct Russian military aggression against the Austrian territory. The other is if Germany attacked France. But France, under Boulanger, for example, started a war with Germany, attacked Germany, and Russia would promise to stay neutral. Right? Plus, there were all kinds of provisions in the treaty, you know, expressing Germany's support for Russian interests in the Eastern Balkans, especially in Bulgaria and the Turkish Straits and so on. How is this to be understood? As an attempt on Bismarck's part to sugarcoat his fundamental political choice, which was the opting for Austria, and to somewhat dilute its political significance, somewhat increase Germany's freedom of action, to give Russia an interest for not aligning herself with France. Right? To suggest to Russia that if she went over to the side of France, she would have something to lose. That if she stayed with Germany, she would have something to gain. But there's not all that much to it. The provisions in the treaty expressing Germany's support for Russian aspirations in Bulgaria, it didn't mean anything in practice because of the logic of the situation. Once you opt for a policy of the containment of Russian expansion, then everything follows as a matter of course. You may talk about how you want a partition of the Balkan into these two spheres of influence, but in practice you can't do it. Because once the Russians dominate the Eastern Balkans, what's going to keep them at bay? What's going to prevent them, once they acquire that new position, from trying to penetrate the Western Balkans as well, which are also full of Slavic populations? Right? So if you want to solve that problem, keeping the Russians out of the Balkans, not because you care about the Balkans, but because you understand that if the Balkans fall under total Russian control, then the Austria's position is deeply compromised. And the corrosive forces within the Habsburg monarchy will be greatly increased. Right. So if you want to keep the Russians out of even the Eastern Balkans, you have to keep them out of all the Balkans. You know? If you want to keep them out of the Western Balkans, you have to keep them out of the East as well, is what I meant. So, but you don't want to have to face up to the implications of that sort of policy. Because what it would mean is that you're opting against Russia. And then what's going to keep Russia from siding with France? Then when Russia sides with France, you're basically much too dependent on your remaining partners, on Austria, on Britain. And can you really put the fate of your nation in the hands of third powers to that extent? So, all right. So this is the best Bismarck can do, the best he can do. Right? Maintaining something, sugarcoating a basic, you know, policy choice, trying to head off the basic policy choice from effecting its full range of consequences. Right? This is the best you can do. But is it correct to say, as Langer says, that this, or suggests, that this system was rock solid, that everyone was stalemated, that nobody can move, that everyone was enmeshed in this situation, that stabilized the status quo? No. Right? This was a tenuous system. It might have been the best that Bismarck could do, but you can see that it was not rock solid. This was not a question of everyone being checkmated. Right? It would not take that much for the Russians to say, "We're not getting anything out of this. These are just honeyed words, but there's no substance to them." And the reason that we can be treated like that, treated, you know, as though our interests were of no account, was that we don't have enough power to stand up to Germany. The only way that we can get independent power is by moving toward closer relations with Germany's main adversary, France. And that way, the Germans are going to have to take us more seriously. Not hard to imagine, right? Not hard to imagine a British policy that was very different from the policy that Salisbury pursued, right? Throwing British power behind the containment of Russia, Well, if Germany has to do it in any case, why should the British pay that price? Allow the Germanic powers to balance Russia. Then Britain would have freedom of action. Britain could balance between the continental powers. She wouldn't have to commit herself, right? Everyone would be seeking out Britain for good relations, right? It's not rock solid by any means. Yeah? So so what that tells us is that there's a structural problem here. It's not as though the situation is so bad that war is just a question of time, right? But this is by no means the sort of political system that provides a very stable basis for international order. Okay, so that's it for 1890. After the midterm, we'll begin with the fall of Bismarck and the post-Bismarckian system.